good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, March the 23rd, 2017, 12:17 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm Scott Spears, along with you for the ride today. This is going to be a great show. I want to let you know really quickly what's coming up next hour. We're going to be joined by legendary newsman Hugh Downs from 2020 in the Today Show. Next hour at 10 after 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to talk about all things going on in the news. And tomorrow, a little programming note, tomorrow at 10:15 a.m., we're going to be joined by our state representative, Jim Jordan, in his first interview after the big health care vote that will take place either today or tomorrow in Washington. We're still thinking today, but it could be tomorrow. But I want to get to this hour because this is a guest I've wanted to have on radio with me since I got into radio. We are going to spend half this hour talking about his very interesting life and career, and half of this hour talking about the current events that are going on in this world. He was the governor of Massachusetts, longest-serving governor of Massachusetts, but I'm sure you might remember him best as the 1988 Democratic nominee for President of the United States. It is a great honor to welcome to these microphones Governor Michael Dukakis. Governor Dukakis, how are you?
I'm fine. I'm teaching during the winter quarter out here at UCLA in Los Angeles, and it's a great place to spend the winter. But we'll be heading back to Boston, where I teach at Northeastern University the rest of the year. So we've had a very good winter. I'm finishing up in the middle of finals, so I've got dozens and dozens of final student papers to read and grade. But we'll be heading back to Boston in early April and enjoying the rest of the year back home.
You know, Governor, when people come into your class, you were the nominee for one of the two major parties for President of the United States in the last 30 years. When people come into the class, do they recognize that? Is there an interesting chemistry there?
Not if they're under the age of 30, and most of my students are not 30. I mean, they may have read about me, but they're wonderful kids, let me tell you. We're producing some terrific young people in this country, and I'm teaching them on both coasts. And in an interesting kind of way, this Trump thing has really kind of revved them up for public service. I'm not happy with Trump for the most part, and it's really got them seriously thinking about careers in public service, which, of course, I love. So I not only do a lot of teaching in the classroom, but spend a lot of time with these young people personally, encouraging them, suggesting internships, and those kinds of things. And I'm not happy, needless to say, with the current administration, but I'm certainly excited about these young people and really love working with them.
I certainly do want to get to Trump before this interview is over, but I want to ask a few questions here. When you left politics, why did you leave politics?
I'm having a little difficulty hearing you.
Is that a little better?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why did you leave politics?
Why did I go into politics?
Why did you leave politics?
Leave it? Well, I had served as governor for 12 years. I had run for the presidency of the United States and unfortunately lost it. And I'm not quite sure there was anything else out there in that sense, but I've never left it. I mean, I've been deeply and actively involved ever since. I am back in Massachusetts. I am nationally. I spend a lot of time on politics generally and more specifically working with lots and lots of very good young people on it. So, you know, once you're in it, you never get out. And I've been actively involved in other people's campaigns, trying to be helpful and those kinds of things. So I haven't been taking a pass or taking a vacation from politics. You know, it's a continuing, important part of our lives, and especially now, given this craziness that seems to be going on in the White House, very important, I think, for those of us who care deeply about the country and deeply about its political system, quite frankly, to be actively involved, and I am.
You talk about your students being energized to get into public life. Has any of this unlikely administration energized you to get back involved in office, running for office?
Well, look, I'm 83 years of age. I feel like $1 million, and I expect to be around for a good long time. You know, my mother used to say that if you want to live a long life, pick your parents carefully. And my dad died when he was 84, my mother when she was 100. And Kitty's dad was still conducting the Boston Pops when he was 94. So the two of us expect to be around for a while. But, you know, I'm not going to run for office again. But I certainly care very deeply about this country, about the world, about the future, and especially about our young people coming along. And so I'm going to be deeply and actively involved, and have been.
I want to talk a little bit about your life. What was your childhood like growing up?
I had a great childhood and a very happy childhood. My parents were both immigrants, my mother from central Greece, my dad from a predominantly Greek town in western Turkey when there were still 1.5 million Greeks in western Turkey. He came over here when he was 15, my mother when she was 9. Both of them did remarkably well. I mean, my dad came here, he was 15, didn't speak the language, didn't have a nickel in his pocket. And 12 years later, was graduating from the Harvard Medical School. How he did it, I have no idea. Became a doctor in Boston. And practiced medicine for 52 years. My mother came over when she was 9. And thanks largely to a remarkable elementary school principal in Haverhill, Massachusetts, she not only stayed in school and graduated from high school, which was very unusual for young Greek immigrant women, but my mother, so far as we can determine, was the first young Greek woman ever to go away to college unescorted in the history of the United States, and went to Bates College up in Lewiston, Maine, graduated in 1925. Equally unusual. So I was blessed with a couple of really terrific parents, a very happy childhood. I was turned out to be a pretty good student in school, and I was very athletic and had a great childhood and great teenage, began getting involved in student politics, school, student council, and that kind of stuff. And by the time I went off to college, I'm not sure I had decided I was going to be going to have a political career, because I was a kind of tentative pre-med until I ran into something called general physics at Swarthmore College, and that was the end of my that was the end of my pre-medical career. But then, while in college, became very active. That was the time when Joe McCarthy was running around questioning everybody's patriotism, and I wasn't a big fan of McCarthy, so got very much involved then. And then, after serving in the military and career, came back to law school in the Boston area, and then began getting involved in active politics.
What was it about politics that appealed to you?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, I kid around and say that that it was all about the fact that I had a third grade teacher in Brookline, Massachusetts, named Mary Ripley, and this was during the middle of World War II, who decided to have election for class offices. This was in the third grade. I don't know why I ran for the presidency of my third grade class. I have no idea why my classmates voted for me, but I was elected president of third grade class, and I'm not sure that was the thing that stimulated me to get interested in politics, but I was always interested. And you've got to understand what kind of country the United States was at the time. Look, this is a great country in many ways, but let me tell you, the United States that I grew up in was racist, it was anti-Semitic, and for some reason, from the time I was 9 or 10, I just couldn't stand seeing folks get angry at people because of who they were, what their religion was, what the color of their skin was. It just bothered the hell out of me. And, you know, some people describe this as kind of a sense of injustice or whatever, but it certainly had a lot to do with my feelings about getting involved and changing things. And as you know, we have, dramatically in many ways. Don't ask me why I had that kind of instinct, but it just drove me nuts to see evidence of racial or religious prejudice, and there was a ton of it around at the time, and I think that had a lot to do with it. Then this guy McCarthy came along, began questioning people's patriotism. That bothered me, and in point of fact, I had a terrific basketball coach in high school who was no fan of McCarthy's, and we used to have long discussions politically in those days about him and what was going on. And it was John Grinnell, my high school coach, who was the first adult who ever said to me, "Michael, you want to run for elective office someday." Nobody ever said that to me, and I had enormous respect for Coach Grinnell. So that had a lot to do with it. And then, obviously, I began, while in college, getting involved and active, and the rest, as they say, is history.
When you ran then, because your personal life does become involved and your time becomes involved, what did it take to run for political office then, and what do you tell your students it takes to run today?
Strangely, despite the fact that obviously communications are different, we're in a kind of electronic age and we've got emails and social media and all that kind of stuff, it hasn't changed very much. I mean, first you've got to be strongly committed to changing things, to making things better. I mean, I don't know if anyone who goes into politics to show up and put in the day. I mean, all of us who run for office, no matter where we're coming from philosophically, doing so because we have very strong feelings about the world we live in. So that's kind of number one. Secondly, you better like people and enjoy working with them. And there's nothing better than working with people and trying to make your life and the lives of your fellow citizens better. I mean, that's one of the things we do. And there's enormous personal fulfillment and satisfaction, Scott, in being in a position where you can make a difference in the lives of people. And after many, many years at this, Kitty and I are still at it, and we still are able to help folks in many, many ways, and it's there's no better feeling, frankly. So, you know, for all of those reasons, one gets involved. And you start slow, and you start at a pretty basic level. I started in local government at a very basic level, and then managed to do fairly well at that level and started moving up, get into the state legislature, and then subsequently was elected governor.
You know, Governor Dukakis, it's kind of interesting, and I think of it this week with President Trump and the whole wiretap story. There is this thing now when it comes to politics that because the president has said things that are untrue, nobody wants to use the term lied, but all politicians lie. That's kind of the backup from the press, or the Trump supporters. He lied, but all politicians do it. You were a pretty heavy-duty politician. Did Michael Dukakis lie? Is that with the territory?
Let me tell you, anybody who tells you that is either a knave or a fool. I can't imagine deliberately lying and being in public life for two reasons. First, it's a dumb thing to do, and secondly, given the press corps we have, the media we have, and so on, you'll never get away with it. Now, frankly, I don't understand at this point what makes Trump tick. I don't know whether he deliberately lies or he says things that are untrue and he thinks they're true. Either way, it's kind of pathological, but you never know with this guy. And then when he says, well, the previous president wiretapped him, then he says, well, I meant wiretapping in a broad sense, whatever that means. Well, you know, you can't be a governor or a president and be free and easy with language. I mean, people are paying close attention to it. If you're president of the United States, you're probably the most important political figure in the world. And as I say, I don't know whether it's deliberate with him or whether it's just carelessness. Maybe it's a combination of both. But it isn't making his life any better. It's not making our lives any better. And frankly, I think I wish he'd just, you know, get off his Twitter stuff and start governing. I mean, we're right now in the middle of a major debate over health care and whether or not working Americans and their families are going to have decent, affordable health care in this country. I mean, that's the fundamental issue here. So this guy during the campaign said, hey, elect me and you'll all have health insurance. And it will be less expensive. And now he's working overtime to try to get a bill through the House, which has to be one of the worst pieces of legislative nonsense I've ever seen. I mean, it's a terrible bill. Millions of Americans will lose their health insurance as a result of it. It's very unfair. It gives the wealthy another tax cut. And this is not what Donald Trump candidate for the presidency of the United States, said at the time, or said, by the way, during the transition. Now, does he understand that he's telling us he's doing now something that is totally contrary to what he told us he was going to do when he was a candidate? I don't know, but I will say this to you. Anybody in public life who deliberately either misstates the truth or knowingly lies about something, first, doesn't belong in public life, and secondly, he's going to be doing a terrible job in himself and the administration he's working for, because nobody's going to put up with this stuff.
I want to kind of weave in and out here and come back to Trump in a second and what's going on nationally, but you're the governor of the great state of Massachusetts. What got into you? What happened where you said, you know, Kitty, I can make a run for president of the United States? How did that come about?
I'd never even thought about it. God, I mean, I was working hard as governor. My state, which had been in very rough shape several years earlier, was coming back. The miracle of Massachusetts, as it was called, was real. I'd had two very good terms and was running for a third and was fortunate enough to win it by a very large margin in November of 1986. And really had literally never given a moment's thought to running for the presidency of the United States. And then we had something called the Iran-Contra scandal, in which the president and vice president of the United States lied to the Congress, deliberately broke the law, ignored what was a clear law passed by the Congress of the United States to stop our continuing intervention in Nicaragua, which was a disaster anyway. And people were shredding documents in the basement of the White House. And I was appalled. I mean, I just couldn't believe this was happening. And it was only then that I began thinking in a very vague way that I might at least take a look at the presidential thing. But I wanted to win my third term decisively. I was able to do that. A lot of people started kind of me and saying, you really ought to at least think about this. And so I said, okay, I want to enjoy this victory. I want to enjoy my family, and which is the most important thing in my life. And after the first of the year, I'll consider it, but it's 10-1 against my running. I mean, I'm looking forward to this third term. I want to do a really superb job if I possibly can as governor. And so for 3 months, January, February, March 1987, I spent some time basically talking to people and asking them, I mean, do you think I'm capable of this? Is this the kind of thing you think I ought to do? I was particularly concerned about my family because I've got a great wife and three wonderful kids. And if even one of them had said, Dad, we don't want you to run, that would have been it with me. Curiously, and by the way, if even one of them had still been in high school, I would not have run. This is not a criticism of other presidents who have brought up their kids. I mean, Obama's, so far as I can determine, have done a terrific job bringing up their kids. But basically, I would not have considered it. But fortunately, all of my kids were either out of college, or our third and last one was in college. And so I spent a lot of time with my family. I mean, is this something you think I ought to do? I mean, do I have the capability of doing it? I mean, you know, what kind of a family life would this mean? I've got two very attractive daughters. And I said to them, you know, you won't be able to go on a date without a Secret Service guy. Do you really want this? Interestingly enough, they were a lot more enthusiastic about my running for the presidency than I was. And very, very supportive. So, and very much involved. And that made a difference. And so I went through this process, and after 3 months, I finally said, okay, I'm going to run, but it's a long shot. You know, the chances are I'm not going to make it. I hope everybody understands this. And then we started putting a campaign together.
You become the candidate. We fast forward a little bit. You become the nominee. And there are three, I think, pivotal moments in the campaign of 1988 that people remember. And just to go back and refresh people, one of those came when mental depression. There was a leak that you had some issues with mental depression. And President Reagan, during a briefing at the White House, was asked about it. And he said he did not want to pick on an invalid, sitting president of the United States at the time. When you heard him say that, what did you think?
Well, I was astonished. I mean, I've got my strengths and my weaknesses. I don't think a depressive character is one of them. I mean, I think if you talk to people who know me, I love life. You know, I love my family. I love the career I've had, notwithstanding the disappointment of being defeated in 1988. And where that story came from, I don't know. Why Reagan said that is still a mystery to me. Because it came out of thin air. You know, it was totally false. And two or three hours later, he came back to the White House press room to apologize to me. But why he did it in the first place, I have no idea.
The next of the three, of course, is the helmet in the tank. How did that happen, and did you think it was that big a deal?
No, I didn't think it was a big deal, and George Bush had been, you know, in a tank three times during that campaign. So, but it was, look, the opposition will do anything if they possibly can. I was trying to emphasize the fact that we were not investing anywhere near as much in conventional warfare as we should have, and we were spending too much time on exotic high-tech weapons. And but let me tell you, I didn't lose that election because I was in the tank. I lost the election for two very important reasons. First, I spent too much time talking to people who I thought knew more than I did about how to win the presidency, all of whom poo-pooed the idea that precinct-based grassroots organizing could win you the presidency. And it was precinct-based grassroots organizing that got me elected governor, and in fact got me elected to the legislature. It took Barack Obama many years later to prove beyond any doubt that precinct-based grassroots organizing elects presidents, too. And secondly, I made a decision, and it was turned out to be one of the dumbest decisions I've ever made, that I was not going to respond to the Bush attack campaign. You know, the country was seriously polarized during the Reagan years. I mean, there's this kind of nostalgia about how the Reagan years were kind of great years and people got along and stuff. That's a lot of nonsense. I mean, it was a highly polarizing time. The country was seriously divided. And I just thought it was ready for something a lot more positive than the kind of thing we'd been having during those years under Reagan. And so I basically said, I'm not going to respond. That was a terrible mistake. I mean, if the other guy's going to come at you and attack you, then you've got to have a carefully thought out plan for dealing with it. And by the time I recognized the kind of damage that was being done by that attack campaign, it was almost too late.
There's one other moment I want to touch on, because I want to ask something about this, and I want to read it exactly because I don't want to misquote it. Bernard Shaw, who was with CNN at the time, was moderating one of the debates between you and Vice President Bush at the time.
Right.
He asked the question exactly, and I quote, Governor, if Kitty Dukakis, your wife at the time, were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer? You replied, no, I don't, and I don't think you know that I've opposed the death penalty during all my life. And you explained your stance. Was that wrong, and would you answer the same way today?
Well, if you're an opponent of the death penalty, as I am, and I have been all my life, you're going to be asked that question in a variety of ways many, many times. And maybe the problem was that since I had been asked it 1,000 times, I responded as if I'd been asked it 1,000 times. And I think probably I should have been a lot more emotional about it than I was. I mean, I love my wife. We've recently celebrated our 53rd wedding anniversary. And we've had a terrific life together and three extraordinary kids and now a whole flock of grandkids. And I think that was the issue. But again, I didn't lose the election because of that question. I really believe I lost the election for those two basic reasons that I talked about. First, the fact that we did not organize at the grassroots the way we should have. And secondly, that I didn't respond to the Bush attack campaign, which just turned out to be a big mistake.
What was Election Day 1988 like? Where did you spend it? What was the feeling? And when the result came in?
Well, I campaigned all night the night before the election. I came from west to east and made a number of campaign stops right through the morning of Election Day. And I didn't stop because I was doing interviews by remote to all over the country, because it was actually very, very close. I mean, I lost, I think, a dozen states by a swing of 3 points or less. So I didn't stop campaigning until, I don't know, 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. You hate to lose. I mean, I not only ran for that office because I care deeply about the United States of America and its future, but, we're very competitive, those of us who run for office, and, you know, thousands and thousands of people had knocked themselves out for me during that campaign. But on the other hand, I was aware of the fact that I was lagging the polls. We were beginning to show some signs of movement. So I never stopped working at it until the polls closed, actually. But you also know that you can lose. And in point of fact, I did. So you prepare yourself for that as well and do the best you can to be a gracious loser.
I always wonder about this, Governor Dukakis. When the call comes in, when they call the election, and you call to concede, at that point you would have been conceding to Vice President Bush,
right.
Father Bush, for people who are listening. What's that? What happened on that call?
We had a relatively short but cordial conversation. I congratulated him and said I'd be happy to be as helpful as I possibly could in the future. We did get together about a month later down at his residence in Washington and talked at some length about the country and its future. But we certainly had nothing like the kind of stuff that we saw during this past campaign, which I thought was just disgraceful.
And I want to get to that here. We're right out of this. But your adversaries for a year, basically, longer now. Do you like George Bush? I mean, he's still living. You might not agree with his policies, but do you like him? Can you get past it?
Well, I'm not sure I know him that well. We weren't buddies. We weren't two people who knew each other, had served together, and that kind of stuff. But I think he's a decent guy. I thought he was a very good foreign policy president and a lousy domestic president, to tell you the truth, which is one of the reasons why Bill Clinton beat him. But I certainly admired what he did in bringing the Cold War to an end with Mikhail Gorbachev, and admired the fact that he was talking about a world's future where we could rule out war as a means of settling disputes between and among countries and build a world community in which, like adults, we could solve our problems without shooting each other. And on the foreign policy side, I thought he was extremely good. Domestically, I didn't think it was good.
Before we get to the current events, and there are a lot of them to talk about in the time we have remaining, but you are one of the two most popular people in the country on Election Day, 1988. What's the day after like?
Well, the day after, I had to go back to work and run the state of Massachusetts. And unfortunately, at that point, we were going into a national recession. So I had plenty to do, I can tell you, and I didn't have time to sit around feeling sorry for myself. I had to get back to work. I had to do everything I could to try to make the last 2 years of my governorship good ones. And they weren't fun because, in fact, the country was going into a serious recession. When that happens, the states really get belted.
Want to spend the last 15 minutes here talking about current events because they are very important. And I want to start with this. We talked about your campaigns and some of the moments people remember. Out of this campaign, our current president, I think people are going to remember the Access Hollywood video. People are going to remember not remembering David Duke. People are going to remember WikiLeaks. Why did Donald Trump get elected?
I think he got elected because, for a variety of reasons, even though the country was and is doing relatively well, especially when you think back to the day Barack Obama took over when the country was almost in free fall and we were lucky not to go into a Great Depression, not alone a Great Recession, there were still large parts of the country which had not recovered very effectively. And I think a lot of the folks in those parts of the country weren't happy and thought maybe this guy would do things better. And so I think that kind of mood, especially in some parts of the country, as I said, where you had not had a full recovery, had something to do with it. I don't think there's any question that what the FBI director did 11 days before the campaign had an enormous impact.
Do you think he did that?
Comey seems to be a reasonably good guy, but why he felt compelled to do that is beyond me. In fact, why he felt compelled to do what he did in July is beyond me. I mean, the job of the FBI is to keep his mouth shut and conduct these investigations and say nothing about them unless and until he has a basis for moving forward with some kind of prosecution. And it now turns out that not only was the FBI apparently investigating Hillary's emails, and that was part of his July press thing, but was also investigating Trump. We never heard anything about the Trump investigation. And quite frankly, it would have been absolutely inappropriate for him to talk about a Trump investigation. That's not what he's supposed to do. So I do think what happened, both in July when he spoke for the first time, and then secondly, this almost bizarre press conference that he had 11 days before the election, which turned out to be a zero, I mean, absolute nothing. And then he had to correct himself 3 days later. Why he felt compelled to do that, I don't know. But I think it had an enormous impact on the campaign. And look, let's face it, she won by 3 million votes. But we still have this crazy electoral college system, which should have been abolished 200 years ago, and which has now made it possible not once but twice in the last 16 years for the winner of the popular vote to lose the election and have somebody else go in and become president of the United States. I mean, I've been opposed to the electoral college system ever since I first learned about it. I mean, it makes no sense at all. Every other election in the United States, the winner of the popular vote wins. And in this case, you had a winner by 3 million votes, and she doesn't become president, which I think is kind of bizarre, and I think we got to get rid of it.
We talk a little bit about FBI Director Comey. Monday, he was the center of all the news channels, and even some network news channels, came to testify, and we found out that the current administration's ties to Russia are under investigation and have been since July of last year. What's your read on Russia and collusion and the Trump campaign?
Look, I have no idea. And under the circumstances, it seems to me that it's his job and the job of his agency to do that investigation, not to talk about it, and then and only then, if they have a strong basis for moving forward with criminal action, to talk about it. And, you know, I don't have any idea what that's all about. On the other hand, you know, we know that we're hacking all the time. I assume we're hacking the Russians. We certainly hacked the German chancellor. We hacked the Mexican president. So who's kidding whom? And what I think would be a lot better for the world and for ourselves and our kids and grandkids is to work hard to create an international community, and that means the UN, which is going to set some rules for the conduct of countries and carry them out. I mean, we participated in the coup d'etat in Ukraine in complete violation of international law. Why did we do that? Now, the guy in office had 11 months to go. He was lousy. I mean, he was a corrupt guy, this, that, and the other thing. But he had been elected. Why did the United States feel compelled to participate in that? I mean, I just don't understand this stuff. I mean, what's going on in Syria? Why are we in Syria? What are we doing in Syria? What's our goal there? I don't understand that either. And so I think we need, you know, some basic rethinking of our foreign policy, of what we ought to be doing in this world. When it comes to us and the Russians, I think we just have to wait until the FBI completes its work. And until then, the less said about it, the better.
A lot of people made this comment during the election: Hillary Clinton is a flawed candidate. What did you make of her as your party's candidate?
Look, I've known Hillary Clinton for a long, long time. She and Bill and Kitty and I were young couples, both governors, young governors. We worked together closely. He nominated me for the presidency of the United States in Atlanta at our convention in 1988. I have enormous respect for both of them. I think the job that both extreme Republican and right-wing organizations and Trump did on her was just outrageous. You may or may not agree with her, but you know, I've known her for years and years. She is a very decent, thoughtful, caring person. And this lock her up stuff was just disgraceful, in my opinion. You ought to apologize to her. But unfortunately, Trump doesn't apologize to anybody.
You know, Governor...
And I just admire her greatly. I'm glad she's slowly starting to get back into public life. I hope she will. She's still got a real contribution to make... to us, to our future, and I hope she will do that. But I thought what happened during the campaign was disgraceful.
You know, Governor, during the election, we had so many people call in who did not like Trump, Republicans, who said, I don't like him, but Hillary Clinton is so corrupt. We've read the books for years and Whitewater and this and that and the other. Is that who she is? I mean, is this really that bad a person?
Look, there was a four-year campaign waged against her with a lot of right-wing money, essentially designed to tear her down. And that went on relentlessly, day after day, week after week, and month after month. You know, why the people who conducted that campaign did that is something they're going to have to explain. But I thought it was disgraceful. But it had an effect. I mean, if you're getting pounded day after day and week after week with all of this stuff, I mean, I don't know if anyone in Washington doesn't have a private email. I mean, it's the only way to get a hold of them. And the notion that somehow this was corrupt, illegal, whatever, I think, frankly, was nonsense. There was not the slightest evidence that our national security was compromised in any way because she happened to have this particular system. But it was part of this campaign. It was part of a deliberate effort to try to destroy her. It didn't really do it because she won by 3 million votes, but it certainly had an impact on the campaign itself, no question about it.
As time goes on, and we're not even 100 days into Trump's presidency yet, but people do talk about his mental state. And it's interesting because of the tweets, because of the Twitter, because of the wiretapping, because of things he says about election crowd inauguration size. Do you give any thought to his mental state?
Look, I don't want to try to psychoanalyze the guy. He is who he is. You know, he's got certain qualities and characteristics that are unique to him. We all do. I just, if he were asking my advice, and he hasn't, I would simply say to him, get off the Twitter stuff, get a good night's sleep, and start acting like a president. And see if you can't be consistent in what you're saying. Don't tell us during the campaign and during the transition you're going to make health insurance available to everybody at lower cost and then begin supporting a bill which does anything but and will throw 24, 25 million people off of health insurance. And he just keeps doing this kind of thing. Try to see if he can be consistent. Try to see if you can... lift people up and lift this country up instead of engaging in what seems to be almost daily warfare with somebody. That would be my advice to him. Is he personally capable of doing that? I don't know. You know, he's got his own personality. We all do. And we've certainly been seeing it in action. But in the last analysis, no matter who the president is, we want a country that's going to be good, successful, is going to contribute to world peace, is going to make this country and this world a better place, and that's what I think any president of the United States ought to be trying to do.
Your party, the Democratic Party, does not control any branch of government right now. Why do you think that is?
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we kind of forgot how to go out and organize. We have 50 states in this country. We have 185,000 precincts. We've got to get back to a 50-state campaign with a precinct captain and precinct organizations in every one of those 185,000 precincts. And I'm not kidding. And there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to do that. We've got to get off this red-blue thing. You know, a state's red, a state's blue. I mean, that's nonsense. The vast majority of Americans are decent, hard-working, middle-class folks that are doing their best to support themselves and their families. And we've got to start reconnecting with these folks on their doorsteps, in their neighborhoods. That's something we have not been doing. And I hope and expect under our new party chairman that we're going to do it.
You know, when you run for president of the United States, win, lose, or draw, you go down in history. When people pull up the name Michael Dukakis 100 years from now, what do you hope they say about the campaign you ran, the type of politician you were, and about that 1988 election?
Let me just say this, and I've got to wrap up at this point. I just hope that they'll think that Mike Dukakis was a decent, honorable person who cared very deeply about his country, who was very proud of his immigrant heritage and what his parents had done when they came to this country, and the kind of support and bringing up that they gave to me and my brother, and that in whatever way I could and have been able to, I helped to make this country better. But let me tell you, I've had an incredible life. I'm still feeling great. I hope and expect I'll be able to continue to make contributions to it and to its people, and nobody could ask for more than that.
Governor Dukakis, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on, and I hope you do come back in the future. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Appreciate
it. Former governor of the state of Massachusetts, Michael Dukakis. How about that? 1988 Democratic presidential candidate. Doesn't get any better than that. We have about 3 minutes left in this segment. If you want to call in and comment on that, feel free, 740-383-9944, on anything that Governor Michael Dukakis said. How fascinating was he? A lot of answers I thought he might give, and a lot of answers I thought he wouldn't give. Always fascinating to learn about somebody. Do want to let everybody know that State Representative Jim Jordan, our state representative, will be along with us tomorrow morning at 10:15 a.m. to discuss the big vote, the big health care vote, which may or may not happen today, which may or may not happen tomorrow. It seems to be up in the air at this point, so we don't really know, but it is going to happen. Again, phone lines are open, 740-383-9944. That's 740-383-9944. And again, 10:15 tomorrow morning, our state representative Jim Jordan discussing maybe a vote that will go down today or a vote that will go down tomorrow. We don't really know when it's going to happen, but it eventually will happen. Glad you're tuned in to WWGH Radio here. Remember, we are always streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. There are amazing archives on the website. Every show ever on this station back until January of 2016, thanks to our webmaster Adam Lepp. You can email us here. Just take our first name and put at wwgh1071.com. So my email would be Scott at wwgh1071.com. We are on Facebook. All you do, and that's where our pictures today were of the big fire. If you go to Facebook and you search WWGH Radio, Marion, Ohio, 107.1 FM, and click like, you'll get information on upcoming guests and pictures and news and information. Remember, we do local news and weather at 10 minutes past every hour, and we are the only station in Marion that does local obituaries four times a day at 8:05 in the morning, 10:05 a.m., 12:05 p.m., and 4:05 p.m. So don't miss those obituary reports. We are the only ones who do those. And again, the number here at the station, as always, 740-383-9944. And we also are available on any mobile device by downloading the free, and it's absolutely free, no joke there, the free TuneIn app, T-U-N-E-I-N-N, app on your mobile device or cell phone, and searching WWGH, and you can hear us anytime, anywhere. We have another hour coming up here on the program. Representative Jim Jordan tomorrow morning. Lots to talk about, lots to do, but we are going to take this quick break and come back in just about 10 minutes. So stay with us here on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM, The Talking Place.
The water up there in Michigan. That's all I can tell you.
And a stupid